people come here tonight in different frames of mind and different consciousness. So let's just take a moment. And with closed eyes or half-closed eyes, just feel within yourself. Let the things of the world just drop away from you. And feel a peaceful energy that is present here. There may be music playing outside. There may be other discomforts or distractions that are there, but just let all of those pass by you. And just feel down in your heart a certain peace, a certain calm. And then sharing that with everybody who's in the room, just let that feeling, however slight it is, just let it expand out. And to feel that this room itself is now a part of you. You are a part of it. And all the people who are here are a part of that one universal energy. And then to go on expanding out into the entire city here. And feel that light, that peace, expanding out with you. Identify yourself with the city itself and the auric field or the energy field of this city. And see all of the disharmonies, all the difficulties, all dissolving into a peaceful presence. Feel yourself to be a part of that. It's as if you are sensing a part of your body. And you would say, well, this finger is my finger, and yet it's not all of me. And so you feel that this entire city is a part of you, and yet it doesn't define you. And you can expand your consciousness even further. Until this entire earth feels it as if it is your body, along with the atmosphere and the energy field around it. And feel that all the discord, all the disharmony is all dissolving into a unifying light of peace. And that as you breathe, the earth itself breathes by its expansion and contraction. And you breathe it, and it breathes you. And feel yourself going out as a prayer for this world. To find that balance, to find that peace, to find that deep inner joy that is inherent in us all. And then to bring your awareness back to your body and just feel how small your body is as you refocus your mind on it. And how difficult it is in many ways to be able to operate in this body and trying to squeeze that vast consciousness that identified with the world into this tiny little body. And how you rebel at that, and how it's difficult at times. And then once again, open your thought to identifying with this world itself. And let your consciousness go on expanding out. finding the freedom in spirit. This freedom and spirit that I'd like to speak to you about this evening. And starting with a story of a wonderful saint from India, Anande Moima. And this is describing a time in her earlier life and what drew visitors to the Shabha gardens was the divine bhava, or the mood, that Ma manifested during kirtan, or singing as we are listening to here tonight. At the sound of the holy name of God, Ma's body would undergo a miraculous transformation. As the devotees sang and danced to the accompaniment of the mrindanga and cymbals, Ma's body would become possessed by a divine power. Her countenance would be flushed crimson, and she would be lifted up on the very tips of her toes, barely touching the floor. She would sway and flow through the crowd to the rhythm of the music. Then her body would drop to the ground, roll and float across the floor with the swiftness of lightning, only to be drawn up full length once again, with her arms over her head, swaying rhythmically with the cadence of the drums. Those who witnessed these bhavas were overwhelmed by their beauty and grace, and felt the power and magnificence of God in her presence. At the end of the kirtan, Ma's body would sink to the floor in deep samadhi, that is, absorption in the divine consciousness. And sacred mantras would issue from her mouth rapidly with perfect articulation. The radiance and majesty of her countenance, while she was absorbed in a trance, moved everyone deeply. One night, a violent rainstorm began during kirtan. Ma was in a divine mood, led the kirtan party out into the rain, and continued singing and dancing in the midst of the storm, taking on the very bhav of the storm itself. And at this time, Ma's young niece, Labanya, was visiting from Shabag. Seeing her aunt in this strange state, she ran up and hugged her, and she was immediately flung backwards to the ground by the unrestrained power emanating from Ma during her bhav. In the darkness of the night and in the press of the crowd, the young girl was not noticed as she fell backwards on the muddy ground. When her family went looking for her, they saw what appeared to be a mound of earth, sweetly uttering the divine name Hari. They pulled the girl out of the mud, but found they could not restore her to normalcy. She had been lifted into a state of extreme spiritual exaltation by the power of Ma's touch during a bhava. When told to stop repeating the name of Hari, she replied, "I see the whole universe as being filled with this name, so how can I stop saying it? Hari, 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 Hari Ba." Finally, her relatives brought her to Ma and asked that she be restored to the normal state of mind. Ma smilingly replied that the yogis practice many lifetimes of tapasya to attain such a state. Yet they were asking her to take it from the child. But, being pressed, she brought the girl back to her formal state of consciousness. What wonderful stories we have. It's with extreme joy that I see you all here tonight. And spiritual freedom is what we all have come for, not just this evening, but in your lifetime. Whether we realize it or not, we all seek out pleasure in different ways. We all seek out happiness in different ways. For the drug addict, they seek the divine experience through a needle or a certain drug. For the alcoholic, through the bottle. Everybody has their ways of looking for the highest happiness, the lasting happiness. And we all think that we can find it in so many different ways. However, we always end up feeling that we're at a dead end. that whatever it is we've been really focused on, thinking that if I just have my life just this way, arranged just so, then I'll have that perfect peace and perfect happiness. But who has it? My wife worked for the man who is the third richest man in the world. And he loves music, and he writes music, and he has his own band. And all of the lyrics are all about negativity, are all about sadness, are all about loneliness, are all about what's wrong with the world. Can you imagine? We think that if somebody has all that wealth and all that prestige and all that power, they should be the happiest person in the world. And then we look around and we look at the people who make it into, you know, those little newspapers at the newsstand when you check out your groceries. And how many of them find happiness? How many of them find joy? How many of them find out themselves in some kind of drug rehab or other kinds of problems, divorces and other kinds of things? And you think, here's this person with everything that the world says should make you absolutely and perfectly happy. And where are they? Do they experience that happiness? Do they experience that joy? Perhaps you could imagine having all of those things that you always thought, boy, if I had all of that, if I just had that thin body, if I just had, you know, that personality that attracted people, if I just had lots of money or at least enough money, seemingly not to have any cares, then I would find peace. I'd just turn that corner. But it seems always that the corner is just ahead of us. And I get the privilege in my position of being able to talk to lots of people about their spiritual journey. And now here's somebody talking about another person, and you say, oh, that person, they've got everything that I would like. Look at the family they have. Look at the business they have, the home they have. Man, if I had that, I'd be on easy street. Then I get the opportunity to actually talk to the person that they've been talking about, that they've held up in such a high ideal. Oh, I've got so many problems with my business, with my family, with my children, and I've got so many worries, and I have no peace. And how often it is that we look to somebody else or think that if we just had things arranged a little differently in life, then I would find peace, then I would find happiness. In 1920, Paramahansa Yogananda came to America, and maybe you've read the autobiography of a yogi or have heard of Yogananda. But he was a tremendous yogi. A yogi is one that, first of all, practices a spiritual discipline or a path for the realization. And India, perhaps more than any other country, has articulated that this state of realization is, number one, it's possible, and number two, it is the proper goal of every human being to strive to attain to this higher realization. And they have been quite scientific about it. These yogis have oftentimes retired from life, although not always, and they've very precisely marked out the different stages of consciousness. They make our Western psychology look infantile by comparison, because what they discovered within the laboratories of their own minds and their own consciousness is that we're made up much more than of this human flesh and our thoughts and our feelings. While all of those are important aspects of being a human being, we're much more than that. We are fantastic, really, in our design. And within us is embedded the potential for rising up into a superconscious state. So most of us are aware of the conscious mind. That's just what we're aware of in our ordinary day. We go about our day, we do the things that we do, and that's our conscious mind. That's what we're aware of at any particular time. And then, as Freud brilliantly pointed out, we have a subconscious mind. And here is a repository of the conscious mind and patterns, things that we oftentimes stuff down into the basement, you might say. Oh, I don't want that. Just put it down in the basement, shut the door, and hopefully it just stays there. Well, it doesn't just stay there. Pretty soon, the sounds and the odors, and it all starts coming up through the heating vents, right, into the main floor, and we go, oh, something's down there, but I don't want to know what it is. So we keep it out. And so through our dreams, through different kinds of behavior, perhaps, that are driven by forces we don't completely understand, the subconscious mind feeds back into the conscious mind. And it forms the habits. I mean, think of what you'd have to do. If every time you got into the car, you'd have to learn how to drive the car brand new every time. Habits are really useful, but they, if they're negative, then they really cause us problems because they just kick into automatic gear. And Yogananda used to tell one story, how he never wanted to be dictated by any habits. So when he first arrived to America, of course, he's from India. India, very influenced by England, as England was influenced by India. Tea drinking was very big. He knew about tea. But since the Revolutionary War in America, tea went overboard, coffee was in. So he was served coffee and different meals and things like that, and he drank it, and he liked it okay. And, oh, this is very nice, discovering a new drink. One day, he's eating a meal out by himself, and he's thinking about ordering coffee. And he says, what is this? I want coffee. I'm not eating with anybody. Why would I want coffee? Because he felt the pull for the coffee. I don't want to be dominated by any habit. That's it for coffee. Out. And think of what we would be like if we did that with all of the things that had a negative pull on us. And we said, no more of that. Out. Out. Well, we'd save ourselves a lot of trouble down the line, wouldn't we? But so the subconscious mind is a very powerful prompter within the consciousness. What most of us have not thoroughly investigated or explored is the superconscious mind. However, I would say that everybody here has had some experience in it. It can come in a dream. It can come in an experience, either because you're following a spiritual path and you're trying to get that experience, or it just comes on you spontaneously one day. You can be looking out over an ocean and just suddenly you feel an expansiveness of spirit. You feel a tremendous sense of peace. You feel an upliftment in your spirit, in your soul. And you recognize, this is very different than my ordinary consciousness. I would really like to stay here. However, it doesn't last. You come back down into more ordinary consciousness, and then you go about your functioning day. But that experience stays with you. Or you have a dream, and in that dream, you have a powerful experience. Perhaps you meet a divine personality, or you find yourself in a very spiritually charged place, and you feel transformed. You feel uplifted. And that's a superconscious dream. And when you come out of that superconscious dream, you feel wonderful. You feel transformed. You feel charged, spiritually charged. This is a wonderful tip-off that there's more to the iceberg than what we've discovered so far, that there's more to consciousness than what we've known so far. So somehow, the yogis began to really explore that. Oftentimes we think of yoga now and we think of physical postures, which are wonderful and excellent for good health, to prepare the body to be able to meditate. It balances the energies. It gets us into a good set in order to be able to dive deeper into meditation. However, it's just a small aspect of what yoga is. In yoga, there are four broad categories. There is the Raja Yoga, which includes Hatha Yoga. It also includes meditation, breath control, life energy control. That's all in Raja Yoga. It also, there's Jnana Yoga. And Jnana Yoga is the discipline of the mind, discerning what is of truth, what is of reality, and what is an illusion. And the mind cannot fully comprehend what truth is. The mind cannot. In the human sense. In the Christian Bible, it says, no man has seen God. And what that means is that no one in a strictly human state of consciousness has seen the divine effulgence. That when you are uplifted in consciousness, you transcend the limitations of what it is to be limited to the human self, which means the body, and the ego consciousness that goes with it. And through that, you're lifted up into that higher consciousness. So the mind can discern what's not that experience. Not this, not that. And it just keeps on sorting through what it isn't, what it isn't. And it's for the one who has a strong mind and has a bent towards that kind of discipline of sorting out, and it's not this, it's not that, it's not this, it's not that. What finally stands revealed is what it is. Even though the mind can't say it, it's lifted up into that experience, and then it knows this transcendent, superconscious mind. So that's Jnana Yoga. And then there's Bhakti Yoga. And Bhakti Yoga is love and devotion. It's what Anande Moyi Ma, she heard this music, she heard this sound, she danced to it, she became enraptured with it, she came into this divine mood. She was lifted up. She was actually, in her case, she was born with that consciousness. And she came with it. She is what is called an avatar, that is, descent of divinity into flesh. She came as a fully realized being. And so this kind of mood, this kind of elevation is something that's gained when your heart is opened, when you feel that love, that devotion, it becomes overwhelming in you. And it lifts you up into that supreme consciousness. And so that is Bhakti Yoga. Bhakti Yoga. And then there is Karma Yoga. And Karma Yoga is the yoga of action. You're unified with divine consciousness in action. You think of Mother Teresa, for instance, of Calcutta, and the way that she served, the way that she saw Christ in every individual that she met, and how can I serve you? How can I serve you? How can I be with you in that divine context? And every person that she met from that state of mind, from that state of thought. At first, it's a discipline. You mentally, you work with yourself to get there. But after a while, when you've actually gotten into that unified state of consciousness, it's a flow of joy and a flow of bliss. Blissful service, seva. Seva is that kind of service to the divine within everybody. Or you're just doing particular actions and you feel that flow moving through you. And that's karma yoga. Karma is action. And it's the yoga or union with the divine through action. And so actually, we all have various parts of all four of those paths. Because we're active people, therefore, we're all karma yogis if we're practicing a spiritual path. Bhakti is essential because that's the positive magnet that draws us. That's the emotional fuel that gets the rocket off the ground. Huh? Otherwise, there's no fuel to get off the ground. The mind has to be the guidance system. And you have to be able to discriminate what is truth, what is not truth. What is greater reality, what is delusion. So that has to be there as well. And the Raja Yoga is the methods. Those are the modalities that we use in order to achieve that higher consciousness. So these four broad categories are all yoga. They're all yoga. It's very big. There's huge number of texts and different disciplines that go along with each one of these. So it's a wonderful fount of wisdom that comes to us. But we also actually have embedded within our own Western world, through Christianity, we have those same truths. Mother discovered Kriya Yoga, which is the yoga, Raja Yoga technique in Ecclesiastes. It's written right there, but it sounds like a weather report. But you have to understand that the wind is breath. It's like the windpipe, huh? And wind is breath. It's written in symbolic language. And so it's all put into symbols. Now, there's a story that's a beautiful story about how this symbology came into this world as parable. And parable walked around, and one day it met another being, and that being was truth. And truth, when it met parable, it says, oh, you're wonderful. Look at these images, these stories, these swirling clouds of light. You're fantastic. And I can see that wherever you go, this is truth speaking, wherever you go, people love you. They love to hear a good story. They love to see your symbols, and they love to be inspired by you. He says, me, however, truth, they don't like to see me come. And when I come, they throw me out of town. And I'm wandering all by myself, and I'm so lonely, and I don't know what to do. And parable said, oh, I'm so glad to meet you. Because it's true, people love to see me. But you know what? I feel like there's something kind of missing inside of me. You know, I'm kind of empty in there. And so truth married parable. Went right into the center of parable. And so you have all of these wonderful stories, all these wonderful symbols and images, all these interactions that are described in these wonderful mythologies and these wonderful religions. And people stay focused on the outer casing, but they miss what's at the center if they don't dive deep into it, if they don't go deeper into what these wonderful stories represent. And these scriptures, these stories, East and West, they're our stories. They're your story. They're my story. They're all of our stories. And it's through these stories that we become informed about what is possible. What is possible? And there are tremendous things that are possible. Many of you are exploring them through work within energy and within healing and within psychology. And within working with the mind and working with the being. And those are wonderful things. But oftentimes they miss the upper story. So if we have the house with the basement as the subconscious mind, the conscious mind is the main floor, the superconscious mind is the attic. And there is a wonderful psychologist who based his work on Eastern mysticism. His name was Roberto Assagioli. And he wrote to Freud. He had been a student of Freud's, and like Jung, he broke off from Freud at one point. But he wrote a letter to him. And he said, you like the basement, to Freud, huh? You like the subconscious mind. He says, the basement's good. There's a lot of rich stuff to work with there. He says, but I like the main floor as well. And better than that, I like the upstairs. And to have an upstairs with a skylight is really nice. Really nice. Light coming in through there. And an elevator to go from the top floor to the main floor to the basement, up and down, up and down. Can we do that? Can we do that? And the answer is yes. The answer is yes. And so we take on our spiritual practices. And we all are spiritual beings. So we're either consciously taking on a spiritual practice, or we're unconsciously working it out. You can say, in one sense of the word, that the drug addict is an unconscious yogi trying to find bliss. But he's going down a dead-end alley. It's not going to get him there. Or that the alcoholic, or the person who thinks that they just have enough money, or whatever the kind of theory it is that they're testing out. And if you try to interfere with somebody's theory, they oftentimes don't like it so much, do they? Because they say, this is my life. If you were in one of those multiplex theaters, and sometimes the walls are thin, and if there's a big boom, boom kind of movie going on next door, you can hear these sounds, and it comes right through. You're listening to this nice, quiet, wonderful kind of movie, very uplifting. And next door, you hear these boom, boom. You go, oh. Those people, they could be sitting in my theater. They could come over here and enjoy this kind of nice movie that I'm watching here. So you go over there and you say, people, they say, shut up, we're watching the movie. No, there's a wonderful movie next door. And all this crashing and all these wars and all of this stuff going on, you could be over here with me. And it's, shut up, we're watching our movie. We want to finish our movie. And if you don't shut up, they pick you up and they throw you out, don't they? Because they don't want their entertainment destroyed. They don't want to give that up. But when you find somebody who says, you know what? I'm tired of this play. I'm tired of this movie. I've seen it too many times. The themes play themselves out the same time every time. I'm getting tired of this. When I was at Anandashram, I was sitting with a great spiritual master there, Swami Satchidananda. And he was telling me about how in North India, there is this difference going on between the Hindus and the Muslims. And the Hindus had done something, and then the Muslims threw some Molotov cocktails on a train, and 40 people died. A terrible tragedy happened while their tensions were very high. And I said, you know, Swamiji, God must like his play out here very much. Because the moment things kind of settle down a little bit, it seems like he just starts stirring the soup and the sediment just comes up from the bottom and it starts rising up to the top. And there's just never the peace in this world that we're looking for. We can never turn that corner where life is just perfect. And even if it is, even if we're married to the perfect person, even if our children are absolutely wonderful, we have all the money, everything that we want, somebody can die, the money can be taken away, that ends. And that's no longer something that will be in our life. I think somebody accidentally turned on the lights. Thank you. So this is the drama that goes on. And Jesus said it in this way. He says, the poor you will have with you always. There will always be disparity. There will always be disappointment in this world. Never will you get things arranged just perfectly and they stay in one place. It's just not the nature of the world. The world is full of change, constant change, a dynamic change. It doesn't mean that we can't make the world better or that we can't contribute to a better world. Or that we can't see a better world. Of course that we can. But there will always be disparities in this world. It will never be an equality. Because that only exists in the superconsciousness. It is there when we rise above the duality of this material world that we find in that supreme consciousness the thing that we have been unconsciously or consciously missing for all this time. It's where the healing happens. It's where the wholeness really happens. We can discover segments of it along the way and get glimpses of it. But it's only when we rise up into that supreme consciousness that we are able to transcend all the limitations that this duality. And then, when with that enlightened mind come back into the material mind, and we look out on this world, we see, it has to be. It has to be. We have to have the light and the dark. Khalil Gibran was not only a wonderful author, he was also a wonderful artist. And some of his art that he drew, and a critic wrote to about his art, and he says he deals with light very well, but shadow he's not so good on. And Gibran says, this critic does not understand art. You can't have light without having shadow. One won't look right without the other. And so there cannot be good light if there's not good shadow in there. You can't have creativity. You can't have creative tension unless there is this mixing of the light and dark. And now when you look out on this world, you go, oh, okay, I understand that better now. In order to have the play, you have to have a villain. How many of us would go to a movie and watch a movie where there's no creative tension? Say, I might as well be home. Why come to a movie for that? I want to see this. I want to see the hero overcoming. I want to see somebody bumping up against the human limitations and what that's like and how they handle that. In order to be entertained, isn't it interesting that we find this entertaining, that our lives aren't entertaining enough on their own, that we go to a movie to find that. But through these stories, like great mythology, it helps inform us about us. if we see somebody handling their problems or their difficulties in some way that uplifts the mind, we think, ah, I could be like that too. I could be like that too. And so this kind of treasure house that you have embedded in within you is something that is really worth going after, really worth aspiring for. It really is the key to real happiness and lasting happiness. You will never find it by rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, because you know what? You know where the Titanic's going. What difference does it make how the deck chairs are arranged? It's all going. And so it's not to say that we shouldn't strive to find a good life, to try to find balance in this world. Of course we should. We need a roof over our head. We need clothes. We need food. We need beauty around us. These are all good things. But not to mistake that for the ultimate happiness that we can only find within us.